I went to an Indian residential school along with many, many, some people here who went to those institutions. It was a pretty harsh place to be, because even though there was 100, maybe 100 other boys and 100 other girls, even your own sister on the other side of the building, you were not allowed to see her or talk to her. But being among all of ourselves, we, in the madness of that institution, we became like family, even though we were completely isolated, we were completely powerless. Many people in their own ways, even as kids in the Indian residential schools, we'd walk away into the furthest field away from the school, and we'd talk to each other in our language, hoping that no one would squeal on us or would overhear us as we spoke. We were in defiance even then as young kids. I never really understood why my parents would send me to an institution like that. So one day I asked my dad, many years later, as an adult, why did you send us to that? Me and my sister, why did you send us? I'll tell you what happened to my sister. She's younger than me, a couple years, and we were brought to the bus to be picked up to go to the residential school, which is quite a ways away. As kids, it might as well have been a million light years away. But as it turns out, it's probably about 80 miles away by road. And we were on a bus, and my sister didn't want me to go, and she was younger, and she was just a little girl, and she let go of my mother and ran onto the bus and came and found me and tried to take me off the bus. But you know what they did? They closed the door and took her to residential school as well. She just reminded me of that. I completely forgot. She reminded me of that about 2 years ago. I remember that, but as kids, you see your parents crying, you see other parents, you see kids in the bus are crying, and you're thinking, what is going on? We didn't know that. We were kids, right? We had no clue. And so in that institution, we were raised and brought up to become civilized, to become Christian. It was the Catholic Indian residential school that I attended. So I knew a lot of Latin because I served as an altar boy. Got to taste wine, by the way. Not because it was offered to us, but we were just curious to see what that priest was drinking. So I'm telling you this because it's part and parcel of this whole notion of, it's so easy to reduce this complexity we call First Nations, Crown relations into and relationships into simple words. And so you need to explain the context. We need to understand the context. So as Indigenous peoples, we have our Indigenous legal systems that we inherited from our ancestors, which was outlawed, as I said, subjugated. And we saw the development of another category of Aboriginal law, or law called Aboriginal law. That was a modern day law structure, concepts, the relationship between the Crown and Indigenous peoples reflected in different kinds of arrangements. This new arrangement became Aboriginal law. Indigenous laws still exist. Tattered as they may be, Indigenous laws still exist. And then you had the development of Aboriginal law, which is a different law. And the court in this country, the Supreme Court of Canada, said that Indigenous legal systems, Indigenous legal laws need to be treated on an equal foundation as common law, English law. Not a lot of people know that, but the Supreme Court of Canada has gone a long way and step in towards the direction that we have been advocating. This morning at 6:45, the Supreme Court of Canada denied an application by the Government of Canada to have that court rehear a case of the Nuchonal people who have a right to fish and to be able to sell that fish on a commercial basis. It went to the Supreme Court. It was decided in the Court of Appeal that the Nuchonal people here had an Aboriginal right to fish for commercial purposes. Supreme Court, it went to the Supreme Court of Canada. The government's brought it there. And the Supreme Court of Canada sent it back to the Court of Appeal, said, we want you to examine this case, re-examine it in light of another decision that they made. So it went back to the Court of Appeal and they re-argued it. And the Court of Appeal here in this province essentially reaffirmed an earlier decision that the Nuchonal people, through their hereditary systems, they brought the hereditary chiefs and their whole hereditary structure before the court to explain how their indigenous laws worked. And the court accepted that. Twice, the second time, and then the Government of Canada said they were going to appeal it, and they, in order to appeal to the court, of course, you need permission from the court to be able to argue your case. Today, the Supreme Court of Canada denied the government's application. So what we now find is that the Nuchonal people have an Aboriginal right, have a right to fish in their territory and to be able to sell that fish on a commercial basis. For many years, people who ended up in jail, there were fined, boats, vehicles confiscated because they went out and fished and sold those in green garbage bags. So the court's been one vehicle that we've used. But at the international level, over 25 years ago, close to 30 now, Indigenous peoples gathered in Geneva that we need to take our issues to the United Nations because our own governments are not dealing with our rights and our peoples in a fair, equitable way. And so it took us close to 25 years to negotiate with governments for the 46 articles in here, the 24 preambular paragraphs that we now call, it's that blue book over there, UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It was adopted by the United Nations, and it's now part of the international human rights legal instruments that we have. We have many different international human rights instruments. The Convention on the Rights of the Child, for example, being a very good one. I want to acknowledge our relatives from the Lillooet area who recently were given the right to appear before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, that they've had to take their case before that international human rights body dealing with children from their communities that are being apprehended by the government through the Ministry of Children and Families. So this declaration, Article 3, talks about the right to self-determination for Indigenous peoples, and 370 million Indigenous peoples around the world, Africa, South America, Central America, Latin America, North Asia, in the Arctic, Northern Russia, the Russian Federation, Eastern Europe, the Pacific Island Indigenous peoples, 370 million. And this declaration says that they have the right to self-determination. So what it's done is codified or put into one instrument human rights, which are already recognized in other instruments, and put it into one instrument called the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Article 3 becomes extremely important because it does define that base, that Indigenous have indigenous peoples have the right to self-determination, to remain and to be who we are. Article 43 says that the rights in this declaration are the minimum standards for the survival, dignity, and the well-being of the world's indigenous peoples. Minimum standards for the survival, dignity, and well-being of the world's indigenous peoples. So what are those standards? I want to take you to Article 25, which I think is really a key article. And I think that's a spiritual center of the Declaration, Article 3 being the heart of the Declaration, Article 43 being the purpose of the Declaration. They're not structured in that way, but in my analysis, that's the way I see them. And Article 25 says that Indigenous peoples have their own spiritual connections to their lands, territories, and resources. And that Indigenous peoples have the right to carry on this. They have the responsibility to carry on these traditions for future generations. The responsibility to future generations. And you never ever see that kind of wording in other instruments, other UN instruments, or even legislation or constitutions that we see in this country. So it brings me to the issue of, took me a long time to get here, about the issue of consent and consultation. And I wanted to maybe go through maybe slide number 4. This young man here is helping me and I'm not following him. It is, as I said, a very comprehensive universal human rights instrument which contains 46 articles and 24 preambular paragraphs. When I became involved in the discussions and the negotiations, there were only 3 articles of the 46 and none of the preambular paragraphs that had been agreed to. After over 20 years of discussion, that's where it stood. And there was strong resistance on the part of many states on this. Dr. Anaya, who was here, a very, very special human being and a very gifted intellectual who was here in the fall and whose report will be coming out very shortly. I had an occasion to discuss this briefly with him at the UN in New York a couple of weeks ago, that his report will be coming forward. His term comes to an end, I believe, at the end of April this year. But his comment on the declaration reads on slide number 4, actually, that's what I'm. Far from affirming special rights per se, the declaration aims at repairing the ongoing consequences of the historical denial of the rights of self-determination and other basic human rights affirmed in international instruments of general applicability. Now, articles, the preambular paragraph number 5-6 talks about these doctrine of discovery, notions of superiority, that the doctrine of discovery was part of international legal norms in the history, in the very early colonial history of this province, that said that as between colonizing powers or European countries, they had, based on the right of discovery, the ability to occupy these new lands. So that's where this doctrine of discovery comes into being. And that is how James Douglas, in February 14, 1859, issued the proclamation that I referred to earlier, that all lands and mines and minerals therein belong to the Crown in fee, based and premised on this doctrine of discovery. Because we found it, it's our right to assume sovereignty over these lands, regardless of who's there. And the other companion piece to that was this notion of terra nullius, that the land was not occupied and used by anyone. Therefore, they had the right to go in and assume sovereignty.